Well, as I mentioned last night, when I had told my friend Ralph Walker that I was coming up here to preach, he immediately assured me that I would find a very welcoming group of people, and you have proven to be that, and then some. It's really been an encouraging week for me to be here, and I just want to thank you very much for the opportunity. I want to thank the elders for inviting me here. I want to thank all of you who've been hospitable and provided meals for me. I want to say a special word of thanks to all of you who have children and you're rushing home from work and trying to scramble things together to get here each night. I know that it can be taxing for you. So a special thanks to you. And it's been great to be with Forrest and with Terry and with Willow. Again, Silas wasn't around when I knew them in Nashville, but it's been great to be with them. I've never really heard Forrest preach or teach, but I've heard a lot of good things from you guys about his lessons. But what was very clear to me when I worshiped with them in Nashville is just what great servants' hearts Forrest and Terry have, which I saw demonstrated time and time again. And I'll tell you what, when you have a preacher who has that kind of heart, I'll take him over a whole pile of others any day of the week. So I know you guys are blessed to have them here, and you feel that way. So it's been great to be back with them. But I am anxious to get home tomorrow, anxious to get back home to my wife. And I don't know about you, but when you hear people mention somebody, if you don't know them, it's a little bit awkward. So I thought I would show you a picture of my wife tonight. So we just went to Gatlinburg a few weeks ago and took this picture down by the old mill stream in Gatlinburg. So that's my wife, Christy. And Kevin mentioned in the announcements that she's dealing with cancer. We've been married about 4.5 years, and just a couple of days short of our first anniversary, we found out that Christy had colorectal cancer, which is a very unusual cancer for someone as young as she is. So we went through the normal protocol of treatments, chemotherapy and radiation and surgery, and we were very hopeful that we had gotten rid of it. But unfortunately, about 1.5 years ago, we found out that her cancer had returned and metastasized into her lungs. And we were told that, all things being equal, the prognosis for someone in her situation with stage 4 cancer is not great long term. We feel very blessed, though, that so far we've been able to hold the cancer at bay. In fact, it's actually smaller than it was when we first found it 1.5 years ago. We're under no illusions of what the long-term future may be, but at the same time, we have great faith in God and great faith in discoveries people make. But it's been a tough pill to swallow, honestly, as newlyweds, as you can imagine. But if there's anything I have learned in the course of our experience and in the course of preaching for many years and traveling a little bit, it is that everybody has a story. I just shared you our story. But every one of you has a story. Some of you have faced cancer personally. Some of you have, like me, seen it in the life of a loved one. And some of you have other kinds of debilitating illnesses or injuries or disabilities that you're facing. Some of you are going through a different set of problems. Maybe your suffering is born because of the loss of a job or loss of income, and you're just struggling to make ends meet. Some of you have a story to tell that's emotional. You've been abandoned by parents, or you've been betrayed by a spouse, or you've been dishonored by your children. The point is, every one of us here, we could just take time tonight and go around the room, every one of us here has a story of suffering to tell. And so far as I can determine, this is really the only argument atheism has going for it. I talked with you Sunday morning about the reason that we should believe in God, that God is the first cause, that God is the one who not only created but sustains everything moment by moment. But things don't always work like they're supposed to. cells divide incorrectly in your wife, and so now she has cancer. Weather patterns go amiss, and there are tsunamis that kill hundreds of thousands of people. People don't always do what they should do, and they deeply hurt you. This is what is called the problem of evil. Evil in the natural world, evil in the moral world of man's inhumanity to man. And it is the primary argument that atheists make to try to refute the belief that there is a God. If you want to set the argument out in step-by-step fashion, here's what it looks like. First of all, evil exists. Nobody here can deny that. In the second place, atheists say if God was all-powerful, he could prevent evil. And every one of us here believes God is all-powerful. And third, if God was all good, he would prevent evil. And yet evil exists. And so therefore, an all-powerful and all-good God cannot exist. That's the basic argument from the problem of evil by atheists. Now, what I want to do tonight is show you how Christianity can deal with this problem. But before I show you how Christianity deals with this problem, I think I need to point out to you that actually this is also a problem for atheism from a couple of standpoints. In the first place, you remember that the other night, Monday night, I talked with you about how the world looks if you are an atheist. How the world looks if you believe there is no God, that all that exists are lumps of stuff. And one of the things we learned in that lesson is that if everything is just lumps of stuff, then there is really no ultimate right and wrong. Let me remind you of a couple of things from Alex Rosenberg's book called The Atheist's Guide to Reality. He says this: we have to give up the idea that core morality is true in any sense. And he also says in his book, if the environment had been very different, another moral core would have been selected for. In other words, according to his view of the world, evolution explains everything, including your beliefs in right and wrong. So just as it's by random genetic chance that I have blue eyes and I have an attached earlobe and all the other features I do, my belief in right and wrong is a product of evolution. But since evolution, according to his view, has no purpose, no meaning, it's just blind random chance, then that means that right and wrong has evolved. It just happened to evolve in a belief that it's wrong to torture babies. But if evolution had taken a slightly different path, what he's saying is this: there could have been a world in which what evolution would have chosen is that the moral position is you should torture babies. So if you weren't here on Sunday morning, on Monday night for that lesson, or maybe you were and you thought, I'm just getting nothing out of this, then you got the lesson. Nothing. Because remember, I've got plenty of nothing. Nothing's plenty for me. That's what the atheistic worldview is. There's no freedom, no purpose, no right and wrong. Since this is the case, can an atheist really meaningfully talk about something as evil? Now, I can talk about things being evil because I believe that there is more to this world than lumps of stuff. I believe there is objective good and evil because I believe in God. And therefore, I can say things like the Holocaust was evil. Suicide terrorist bombing is evil. Betraying a spouse in adultery is evil because I have a view of the world that accounts for good and evil. But if you believe all that exists are lumps of stuff, how can you even meaningfully talk about good and evil? Now, I know many atheists who have strong moral beliefs. I'm not denying that. In fact, I know atheists who probably live a better moral life than a lot of professed Christians. I bet you do too. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is, how do you account for evil? How do you even define what evil is in a meaningful way? So that's one problem for atheism. Here's the other issue. Not all forms of evil are man's inhumanity to man. Some of the evils we deal with are pain and suffering. But do you remember what we also talked about on Wednesday night? According to the atheist view of the world, not only is there no right and wrong, it's not just simply that you can't think about what's right and wrong, you can't think about anything. In fact, you don't even have any consciousness. After all, if all that exists are lumps of stuff, think about it. Here's a lump of stuff. Does this pulpit have any conscious thought about anything? No. And if I'm materially the same thing as this pulpit, that means I don't have any conscious thoughts about anything either. Which means this: there is no reality to the human experience of pain and suffering. You may think you experience it, but all that you can really say exists is certain nerve fibers are firing. Remember this quote from Monday night? One of these people says, "You shouldn't say I'm in pain. You should just simply say my C fibers are firing instead." Let me show you another example of this same philosophy. There are a couple of professors, a husband and wife philosophy team named the Churchlands, that New Yorker magazine did a story on a few years ago. They take the very same view. There's no such thing as thinking or consciousness. The only thing that exists is the lump of matter called your brain, operated by the laws of physics. In the course of the article, it talks about what the woman in this couple said to her husband upon arriving home after a bad day. "Paul, don't speak to me. My serotonin levels have hit bottom. My brain is awash in glucocorticoids. My blood vessels are full of adrenaline. And if it weren't for my endogenous opiates, I'd have driven the car into a tree on the way home. My dopamine levels need lifting." Now, honestly, I would just like to see what the Valentine's Day cards look like when these people pass back and forth to each other here. But you know what? At least she's being consistent. She can't really say, "I'm upset because I've had a bad day," because there is no her to be consciously upset. All she can talk about are the biochemical processes taking place in her body. Well, if that is the case, do you see what the problem is for atheism? It isn't just that an atheist cannot rationally account for good and evil. By this view of the world, they cannot even account for the experience of suffering. Now, just because atheism is absurd doesn't mean Christianity is right. So what I do want to do tonight is tackle this problem of evil head on. And there's a couple of things that I want to put into place before we look more closely at that argument once again. So Sunday morning in class, I use this illustration to help us understand God's relation to creation. If you weren't here, here's the basic illustration. There's a painter, and he has a long handle with an attachment, with a roller pad, and paint. That paint cannot get itself up on the wall. It has no inherent power to get up on the wall by itself. The roller pad has no inherent power to put paint on the wall. It has to be moved by the roller. The roller has no inherent power to put paint on the wall. It needs the attachment. The attachment needs the handle. None of those things working together can put paint on the wall unless there is a what? Unless there is a painter. That was the argument from Sunday morning. And in that way of thinking, what we said is the painter would be the first cause, in the sense of he is the cause that ranks above all others. He is the cause that doesn't need a cause himself, but he gives power to the handle, the attachment, the roller pad, and the paint. He has primary and underived power to make things happen. Everything else in that illustration, the handle, the attachment, the roller pad, the roller, and the paint, are secondary to the painter. They all derive their power from him to make things happen. So we might say that God is the first cause, and everything else in creation are secondary causes. So someone wants to know then, well, why is it that in the world, not everything works like it's supposed to? Whether it's the weather, or cells, or even people. Well, here's the key thing to understand. God is the first cause, and he sustains all of these secondary causes, sunshine, rain, soil, to make the grass grow. But that's not the same thing as saying he necessarily determines what they do. So let me give you this illustration. I don't know how many of you have actually done this in practice, but I would bet that in an audience of this size, we've got parents, or more likely maybe grandparents, who have made this deal with a daughter, son, or granddaughter, grandson. They've said this: well, it's your birthday coming up, and I'm going to give you, you pick the amount of money, all right? I'm going to say $25. Willow, I'm going to give you $25, and I'm going to take you out to the store of your choice, and you can spend that $25 on anything you want, okay? Not really. This is just an illustration, okay? It's just a story here, all right? So now let me ask you this question. Does Willow have the inherent power to spend $25? Did she have a job where she went out and made $25? Nope. I've given her that $25. So in terms of her having money, I am the first cause. I had the money. She had to get it from me. She would be secondary. And unless the store is right across the street, she probably doesn't have the inherent power to go to the store. I'm going to carry her to the store. Once again, I'm sustaining that. But even though I am sustaining her ability to go to the store and her ability to buy something, I have given her a certain amount of freedom. And she can use that money as she wants. Now, as the parent, I might reserve the right to say, you know what? I don't think $25 worth of bubble gum is the best way to go here. So I might intervene. I reserve that right. But do you see that I can give her and sustain her with the ability to go buy something, and yet she can still have freedom to do with that money as she wants? Everybody get that point? All right, well, that's what the Bible teaches about God and his relationship to us. God is sustaining everything. But he has also invested his creation and his creatures with a certain amount of freedom. And he allows us to use that freedom sometimes to do things that are against what he would prefer. God has given us that freedom. Here's another point that's really important to understand. When we talk about the problem of evil, what are we exactly talking about? So here's an illustration. Here's a dark room, but there is light shining into it. If I were to ask you, what is darkness? Most likely you would say it is the absence of light. If I ask you, what is blindness? You would say it is the absence of sight. Deafness, the absence of hearing. Paralysis, the absence of moving. Now, in the case of all of those evils, we're not talking about a something, are we? We're talking about the absence of something. That's how we need to understand what evil is. It is the absence of something. So think about the light and darkness. Just think about the language of Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and on the first day he said, "Let there be light." God created light. God did not create the absence of things. He created things. He created light. He created sight. He created hearing. He created things. But sometimes, in the freedom that God has chosen to give his creation, sometimes things are not all that they should be. Whether it's in terms of physical processes, or especially, we think about it, in terms of the way people treat each other. God has invested us with freedom. Again, like in the illustration, I'm going to let Willow use that money to buy what she wants. But sometimes that freedom can be misused. So when we think about evil, we need to understand, why did God create evil? That's the wrong question. God didn't create evil. He created what is good. In fact, isn't that the recurring refrain in Genesis 1? And God saw that it was good. That's right. Evil is when something has gone amiss out of what was good. Now, with those two points in mind, understanding that God can be the first cause, but still invest his creation with a degree of freedom, and that evil occurs when in the midst of that freedom, some things are not all that they should be. Let's take a look again at this argument from atheists. We're going to have to pick a spot to attack it, right? Because as it stands, if the first three points stand, the conclusion is valid. So we got to tackle it somewhere, right? So, point one, evil exists. Can we really argue with that? No. We just look around the world. You can see evil exists. Point number two, if God was all-powerful, he could prevent evil. Do we believe God is all-powerful? Yeah. Do we believe that God could prevent evil? Yeah, we believe that. So we're not going to be able to tackle this here at point number two. That only leaves us point number three. But even then, the first half of point number three, we all believe as well, right? We believe God is light, in him is no darkness at all. That's the Bible's way of saying he's perfectly good. So there's only one part of this argument that we can really focus on to criticize, and it's the second half of point three. If God was all good, he would prevent evil. Now, here's what this really means. What the person who says this really means is this. If God was all good, I can't think of any good reason why he would permit evil. But wait a minute. Is the fact that I can't think of any good reason any kind of proof that therefore there isn't a good reason? Is that a proof of that? Can we say for certain that an all-powerful, all-good God must prevent evil at every possible occurrence, that there would never be any reason for permitting it? Well, once you ask the question like that, you realize that's not necessarily true. In fact, what we can say is this. If the argument we made on Sunday morning's class was valid, then we established by simple common sense observation and just a little bit of reasoning that God does exist. We established that on Sunday morning. So what we are left now with here is a question. I believe God's all powerful. I believe he's all good, and yet evil exists. Why would he permit that? We're left with that question. But the fact that we have this question in no way challenges what we proved on Sunday morning. Because a question or a puzzle is not the same thing as a proof. And I want to illustrate that for you like this. The other day I happened to see a YouTube video and I screen captured it just to show you what the first part of it, the first few seconds looked like. By someone who is what they call a truther. This is somebody who denies that the terrorists actually perpetrated 9/11. They have a conspiracy that somebody else did it. And here was the argument of this video. So how many of you have seen the video of the terrorist hijackings going into the World Trade Center towers? How many of you have seen that video? Okay. How many of you have seen video of the plane hitting the Pentagon? Anybody seen that? Well, in actual fact, we have seen the pictures of the results of that. But so far as we know, no video has actually ever been released of the plane hitting the Pentagon, at least as clearly as what you can see in the World Trade Centers. So here's what this video says. Everybody has seen the video of the planes going into World Trade Centers, but nobody has seen a clear video of the plane going into the Pentagon. And yet, the Pentagon is the center of the U.S. Defense Department. It has to be one of the most secure buildings in the world. Surely it had security cameras everywhere. Why is it that we've never seen video footage so clear of the plane going into the Pentagon? That's the question. It's a good question. It's a puzzle. But here's the thing. Is that proof, therefore, that the terrorists did not attack the Pentagon? No. And here's the reason why. While it is true that there is this puzzle, there is overwhelming evidence that the terrorists attacked the Pentagon. Let me show you what some of that evidence is. First of all, there are over 100 eyewitness accounts of the plane striking the Pentagon. You can go to this website, for example, and see these interviews. Not only that, there was a massive amount of debris of the actual jet in question recovered from the Pentagon, from where it struck the Pentagon. There is the radar technology that traced out the route of the plane as it diverted from its course and then struck into the Pentagon. Not to mention testimony from the terrorist organization itself. So there is massive, overwhelming, incontrovertible evidence that the terrorists ran a plane into the Pentagon. There's no question about that. But there is this one puzzle. Why haven't we seen footage released of it like we did from the plane striking into the World Trade Center? Now, that is a puzzle. But what I want you to see is that's not proof that it didn't happen. It's just a mystery. And if you think about it just a little bit, you can start to think about some reasons why. First of all, according to all of the evidence, the trajectory of the plane that hit the Pentagon was incredibly low. There is actually footage of the impact taking place, but because it is so low, it's not as dramatic as the planes going into the World Trade Center. In the second place, what is it? Isn't it possible, for example, that the video cameras which were covering the Pentagon were not positioned to catch a jetliner flying just a few feet above ground? Isn't it possible that the impact was so quick relative to the scanning range of the cameras that it would have been very hard to pick up? Maybe, given how sometimes government works, the cameras weren't working that day. I mean, there's a lot of reasons you could think of to explain this puzzle. But even if you never figure it out, even if you can never sort out and come up with a good reason why there isn't clear footage of that impact, does that mystery change any of the mountain of evidence that it did take place? Of course not. I want to suggest for you that the same is true with the issue of the problem of evil. If we made a good argument on Sunday morning, then we made a compelling argument that God exists. The issue of evil in the world is certainly a puzzle. And believe me, when I say puzzle, I don't mean just some kind of academic puzzle. It's a heartbreaking puzzle. But the fact that evil exists, as puzzling and mysterious as this is, does not in any way undermine the evidence that we see for the existence of God. But let's take it a step further. Let's go back and look at this argument again. We said if you were going to try to tackle this argument, really the only space available is the second half of point three. If God was all good, he would prevent evil. A moment ago, I suggested that if we cogitate on a little bit, we can surmise some possible reasons why no clear footage of that jet hitting the Pentagon exists. Let's apply some thinking and ask ourselves, are there any reasons why an all-powerful and all-good God would actually allow evil? Here's some reasons I've come up with. I bet you could come up with even more. First of all, the Bible says in 1 John 4, verse 8, God is love. That's his very nature. And that God values love. He loves. And God desired a relationship with his creatures who would love him in return. But love by its very nature requires a degree of freedom. God did not just want wind-up toys. He did not just want puppets on a marionette string. He did not just simply want a computer program that he could input data and then output the result. So maybe one thing we should consider is this. Because God is love and values love, he valued it so much that he invested his creation with a certain amount of freedom, knowing that that freedom could be misused. But in God's mind, that freedom is worth the loving relationship he desires with all of us. Here's a second point that we could consider. Perhaps God permits evil because, since he is all-powerful, he knows that whatever evil there is, he is powerful enough to work through that evil and bring about some good as a result of it. Can you think of any Bible stories where God worked through evil circumstances and brought about great good? To me, the classic illustration is the story of Joseph, who is sold into slavery as a young boy, goes into the land of Egypt, but eventually rises to second command in Pharaoh's court. And by that position and by God's supervision of his dreams, he is able then to offer a solution that saves the world from famine, including his family. And you remember the famous verse right at the end of the book of Genesis, in Genesis 50 and verse 20, where his brothers are very concerned that once Jacob dies, he's going to try to strike them down in vengeance. And Joseph says, look, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for what? For good. Because God is all powerful, he can use the evil of Joseph's brothers. He can use the evil of Potiphar's wife. He can use the evil of unjust slavery and imprisonment, and through those evils work out some greater good. A good that, in fact, would not have happened had Joseph never gone down into the land of Egypt. So we can say this: God is all powerful and he can bring good out of any evil. Here's another point. In many places in the Bible speaks of suffering as a tool that God uses to refine our character. Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 7 that we are being put through a testing, like metals being put through a fire, so that the impurities can be removed and so our faith can be tested as genuine. Another possible reason why God would permit evil is because he knows that through that evil, our character can be refined. So here's the situation. I said at the start of the lesson, everybody here has a story to tell about suffering. I got another question for you, and this time I'm going to ask you to raise your hand. All right? So here's the story I'm looking for. How many of you can tell a story about a period of suffering in your life, a moment of adversity in your life, that although it was unpleasant, it turned out to be a blessing for you, and you were in fact a better person as a result of having gone through it? If you can tell that kind of story, raise your hand. Many of us in here can tell that kind of story. And what I want you to see is that God can use our suffering to test and refine our character so that we end up being a better person as a result. And if love is so important and so valuable to God, I can't think of a better way for God to refine our character so that our love is unselfish than by permitting us to go through suffering so that our love is from the purest of all motives. And here's another point to consider. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 17, Paul says, "For our momentary light suffering is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison." If we believe that God is all powerful, and if he has demonstrated his power even over the worst kinds of suffering and death itself, by raising Jesus from the dead, then isn't it possible that even the very worst suffering God can deal with by promising us an infinitely beautiful and glorious life with him forever? Our momentary light suffering produces for us an eternal weight of glory. So if you want to think about it like this, when I was a little child, no one ever really wanted to play with me on the seesaw very much. Would you like to take a guess why? Well, because, you know, you get some little boy like Silas on one end, and then I plop down on the other, and Silas is in space, right? I mean, that's what would happen. There's no comparison. Paul says our suffering, as real and heart-wrenching as it is, and by the way, if you're familiar with his life, you know that he endured terrible suffering. But he says, in comparison to eternal glory, it is momentary and light. There is an eternal weight of glory waiting us. Maybe another reason we could suggest that God permits suffering is because he knows that through that suffering, he will provide us with something infinitely greater. Now, those are some reasons that I can think of to suggest for you why God would permit evil. And then here's at least one more thing I can say to you. We may never know. I know that in many respects, mine and Christy's relationship with God and with each other is much better as a result of her suffering. I can say that. But I have days where it's tough. And I have days where we both look at each other and we wonder, why did this happen? I know we have songs in our song books that tell us we'll understand it better by and by. Maybe we will, but it doesn't seem to me like Scripture promises us when we get to heaven, God has a big answer key for all of the mysteries of life. I may never know. But that doesn't change the truth of his existence. Here's what it does mean, though. It means that I need to trust him. And that's really what faith in the Bible is all about. Faith in the Bible is not some blind leap in the dark. We have reason to believe that God exists. Reasons like we've talked about this week. What faith really is in the Bible is trusting God even when it doesn't look like the world makes sense given what we believe about him. And what God calls upon us to do is, with good reason to believe that he exists, but also dealing with the sorrows and turmoil of life, is to hang in there and be faithful to him, to trust in him, even when it is difficult. And to believe that in spite of the painful puzzles that break our heart, that we will see him someday. One final thing I want to say to you, though, about the problem of evil. On Sunday in the sermon and Sunday in the table talk, we talked about who Jesus is. He is God with us. That's the final thing I want to say to you about the problem of suffering. What we as Christians believe is that God came in human form and entered into the human story and suffered on the cross. Have you ever been abandoned and betrayed by someone? Jesus has. Have you ever been afraid and crying out to God and wanting to know where he is? Jesus did. Have you ever suffered and bled? Jesus did. And what the cross is to all of us is God's assurance that he knows and understands our suffering because he took upon himself the worst. The book of Hebrews says this. This final passage I want to read in our time together in this meeting. If you'd like to turn with me, it's in the second chapter of Hebrews. Second chapter of Hebrews. I'm going to start at verse 14. It says, "Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery." And then the writer says this in verse 16, "It is surely not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham." Jesus didn't come in the form of an angel. He came in the form of flesh and blood. Therefore, verse 17, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of his people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. When I look at the story of Jesus on the cross, I may not ever understand all the mysteries of the problem of evil, but I can know absolutely for certain that God knows what it is like to suffer. And so no wonder the next verse, the first verse of chapter 3 says, therefore, holy brothers, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus. In your suffering, my brothers and sisters, I have two words for you. Consider Jesus. Keep your eyes on him. And tonight, if you need to begin the process of a life with Jesus by coming to trust in him and turn from your sins and be baptized into him, we'd love to help you to do that. I just can't imagine dealing with life and what it throws at us without him. And if you've decided you don't want to do that any longer, we'd love to help you tonight while we stand and sing together.